Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, in her work on death and dying, I think was one of those who opened up the door for this subject, for this topic. You interviewed one of her research partners. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people know enough of the story of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, right?
And well, give us a little highlight. Some people don't. You know, believe it or not, we've got a lot of young people that listen to this program now, Steve, and they probably don't know who she is or was.
She's that person who has affected your life or the life of your loved ones, certainly those who've already passed on, whether you realize it or not, because she became famous as the author of On Death and Dying, which, you know, everyone should read. She sat and listened to terminally ill patients at a time in the 60s when terminally ill patients were ritually ignored. The medical profession itself seemed to, and I mean ignored psychologically, right, in terms of what they needed at this time in their lives. The medical profession kind of operated in a state of denial and often wouldn't even tell their sickest patients that they were dying. So Kubler-Ross sat with them, she heard their stories, and she wrote this titanic book that really did change the world. Not many authors ever get to say that, but Elizabeth Kubler-Ross could, because she forced people to confront the elephant in the room, death. Most people, even if they don't know her name, they know about the five stages of grief. You can probably recite them. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And so with that book, published in 1969, she becomes an overnight international superstar, the very public face of the hospice movement. And, you know, in the book, George, I write about the death of my own mother who suffered from a terminal illness, because to me that really brought home how big a contribution Kubler-Ross made to society and how important the hospice movement is. Because my mom's experience was a lot better than the experiences you read about in On Death and Dying. And so that was Kubler-Ross's achievement, right? She did that for people all over the world. Now, some people also know that 6 years later, she endorsed Raymond Moody's book, in which he coined the phrase near-death experience. The tunnel, the light, the meetings with deceased relatives, all these things that people report from a near-death experience. And she became very closely associated with NDEs and New Age thinking from that point on. But what's less well known, and to some extent nobody knows till now, just how close she came to including these stories of near-death experiences and deathbed visitations in her masterwork on death and dying. So, yeah, I interviewed her research partner, the Reverend Walamu Amara, who worked alongside Kubler-Ross in the 60s. And he had a different name then. He subsequently changed it. And just for the sake of convenience, I just, you know, refer to him by his current name.
Right.
And these were really some of the most moving interviews, George, that I ever personally conducted, because these two sat by the bedsides of dying patients every day, listened to them, did their best to console them, counsel them. And they endured, because of that, an awful lot of suffering really themselves by taking in all these stories of pain and regret. Dreams that would never be achieved.
That would wear me down.
Well, it would wear down anybody, right? Could you imagine that's how you spend your 8 hours every day? So they were in uncharted territory, too. I mean, Kubler-Ross became famous precisely because there wasn't a lot of literature available already, virtually none, about what it was like to go through a terminal illness. So
she was even ahead of Raymond Moody, wasn't she?
Oh, by 6 years,
yeah.
Ahead of Raymond Moody. And look, in psychological terms, she was ahead of everybody because nobody had ever sat with this many patients as they were dying before and listened to the stories they had to tell. And here's where the story turns, right? Because they didn't just hear stories of suffering. They had patients spontaneously tell them about other things that happened to them. For instance, when they were resuscitated, they would recover enough after the resuscitation. Maybe they'd had some traumatic event, an accident or a heart attack. They'd wake up ultimately and they'd report what struck both Reverend Amara and Kubler-Ross at the time as impossible things, you know.
Yeah.
So they'd talk about the near-death experience. They'd say, I floated out of my body. I witnessed the resuscitation of my body.
I saw the light.
The light, the meetings with deceased relatives. And they seemed to describe the things they saw in the hospital room itself, or wherever they were, accurately. And it was all the elements of the classic near-death experience years before anyone heard the term. So this is in the 60s, and Moody's book doesn't come out until 1975. actually putting forth that, that this is something that goes on, and say 10% of the resuscitation cases might report this. The numbers vary depending on the study you're looking at, but something like 10%. And so if that wasn't enough, George, to set them back a few steps, there was another class of paranormal experience, and these would be the deathbed visitations that, that patients often told them about too. And this was when a desperately ill patient would report seeing a deceased relative or loved one there at their bedside. And George, this clearly, I mean, for a lot of people, and even for me, this sounds like initially this must be some sort of delusion or illusion. This person is ill. But if you work in a hospital, you do see people caught up in an illusion and who reach in some sort of delusional state pretty frequently. Certainly Kubler-Ross and Amara were familiar with this. And this seemed different. So people who were experiencing some sort of illusion, they seem incoherent and unaware of the other things going on in the room around them, aside from the kind of fantasy thing they're focused on.
Sure.
But these people were quite lucid. They seemed perfectly aware of their surroundings, and they could even carry on conversations, I'll just put it this way, right, with both sides, so to speak, the people there in the room with them and the people that no one else could see.
Can you imagine what it was like for Kubler-Ross and her assistant to hear these stories for the very first time, truly before anybody even documented them in a book form?
Right.
And to hear these similar stories from people, I mean, it must have been hair on your arms would pop up.
Yeah, and they didn't believe them. I mean, initially they didn't believe them and they didn't know how to react. And it's funny to say that, right, because Amara is a reverend. And you would think that, you know, as a reverend, he has some belief in the afterlife. But it's a weird thing with paranormal experiences. Like, people at the far poles of belief and unbelief, so people who are, say, dogmatically committed to some religion, or people who are dogmatically committed that there can't possibly be any truth in any of this, they both tend to reject these sorts of experiences. It's the people in the middle who tend to be open to them. And so Reverend Amara really rejected this, and Kubler-Ross, as Amara puts it to me in the book, was sort of knocked from her moorings by it. And can I give you a quick example of one of these deathbed visitation stories?
Sure, absolutely.
So Amara told me about visiting a little girl who was dying. He had spoken to her many times, and one day as he was starting a shift, he went in to say a quick hello to her. So she has a terminal illness, and she was one of his patients, and Kubler-Ross's patients. And the girl started telling him a story about a man who visited her earlier in the day. And she was being very light and pleasant about it all, but she said that she didn't know who this visitor was. It was a man. She described him as having been very kind. But, of course, Amara saw this as a very serious security breach. A stranger had come and talked to this vulnerable little girl who's confined to a hospital bed. So in front of the girl, who remains calm, and asks her for details of what the man looked like, precisely because he wants to pass this information on to security. And so at that point, he takes it upon himself to stay near the girl's room to prevent this guy from coming back and also to intercept her parents when they arrive. And so when her parents get there, he pulls them aside before they can ever get to the room and says, "Look, everything's fine, but I need to speak to you." And by this time, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross herself was present. She'd been brought up to speed. And now, look, George, nobody's thinking about anything paranormal at this point. Right.
Right? They probably don't even know what that means at that point.
Right, exactly. It's not even on their radar.
Yeah.
So the four of them leave, and they go to this conference room. And Amara goes ahead, describes what's going on with this woman's daughter, and the husband's there too. And he describes this man, and he's just in the middle of assuring them that, look, whoever this was will not get in again, when suddenly the mother interrupts him. She asks him to describe the man a second time in detail. And when she hears the description, she swears this sounds like her own dead brother, the girl's uncle. So she's startled by this, and she stands up. She walks off to her daughter's room to hear her child describe the man. And her daughter corroborates the story a second time. Her daughter seemed to be describing the uncle she'd never met, his clothes, his manner of speaking, his physical appearance. And these were the sorts of events that did repeatedly crop up in their research.